طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. What is happening inside Israel's right-wing government, and what role does violence and extremism play, particularly in its domestic and regional policies, and their execution in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza? Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, discusses this with Middle East scholar Elizabeth Jachar. It begins with introductions.
Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Laura Friedman. I'm the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today is June 8th, 2021, and it's my pleasure to have with me Elizabeth Zirkov. Elizabeth is a friend of mine who I admire tremendously. She is a doctoral student in political science at Princeton University. Her research is based primarily on a large network of contacts she cultivates via fieldwork on the ground in the Middle East, including in Syria and Iraq. She is also a research fellow at the Forum for Regional Thinking, a progressive Israeli-Palestinian think tank based in Jerusalem, and New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy. Elizabeth has worked as a consultant with the International Crisis Group, the Atlantic Council, and the European Institute for Peace, among other places. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Foreign Policy Magazine, New York Review of Books, Haaretz, War on the Rocks, The New Republic, The New Humanitarian, among other outlets. And Elizabeth is proficient in Hebrew, Russian, and several Arabic dialects and Modern Standard Arabic. She is enormously impressive, and we are really so honored to have you with us today. I know you have a very busy travel and work schedule, so thank you. Elizabeth, I have been dying to get you on the podcast. I have so many questions for you. We're going to try to cover a lot of ground in a relatively short time. I will tell for our listeners that the through line in the question, these are not random questions, the through line is extremism and illiberalism and how that is the arc of that through the Middle East as a region. So I'm going to start focusing on Israel, and then we're going to zoom in and zoom out and then zoom back in. So starting with Israel, and anyone who follows you on Twitter knows that you cover this stuff on a regular basis. You think about it, you write about it, you have great analysis. So I want you to offer us some insights into Israeli society today and the extremist forces that are now so clearly in view. And when I say clearly in view, we're talking about the results of the last election, which brought Kahanists into Knesset. For people who don't know, Kahanists are followers of Rabbi Meir Kahane. It is an extreme, extreme political movement that was deemed racist by the state of Israel, and Meir Kahane was thrown out of the Knesset. This is back in the 80s. And the two groups that he founded, Kach and Kahane Chai, or Kahane Chai as an offshoot, are both on the U.S. Foreign Terrorist Organization list. But it's also true if you're looking at what happened after that election, when followers of these Kahanist, these people who are following the footsteps of Meir Kahane, descended on Jerusalem during Ramadan to deliberately stoke conflict. That's where you saw, you know, death to Arabs, people marching in the streets. Or it's true whether you're talking about the organized violence that we saw during the last Gaza war inside the Green Line. And there was violence on both sides, no question, but the organized violence inside Israel was striking and in many cases involved, again, these extremist forces coming in from the outside or forces that had grown into the so-called mixed cities of Israel, and you saw violence. And the last example I'll point to is maybe counterintuitive for some people, but it's the death threats that we're seeing against the right wing MKs and political leaders for their agreeing to displace Bibi Netanyahu as the head of the Israeli government. We're also having death threats against some left-wing legislators as well, but that's a different thing. But here you're talking about something that feels very much like the Rabin era, right? So Can you weave all that together and explain what is happening inside Israel today?
So I think that the violence that we witnessed during the Gaza conflict and the threats that we're seeing now are the result of kind of three main processes. The first is basically the violence that existed in the West Bank, kind of infiltrating Israel proper. Much of the violence that was carried out in mixed cities such as Lod and Ramleh, Bat Yam as well. There was an attempt to march at Jaffa, but was stopped. So the violence occurred in Bat Yam, was carried out by settlers who came from West Bank settlements and outposts that are illegal even under Israeli law. This includes hilltop youth, Noar HaGvahot, and also settlers kind of from the mainstream of settler society. There was a major contingent from Itzhar, and they basically carried out pogroms that they carry out regularly in the West Bank. Just they did so in Israel proper. And similarly to what we're seeing in the West Bank, where IDF soldiers stand by and do nothing to stop the violence, there are multiple videos of the Israeli police doing nothing as basically Jews attack Palestinian citizens of Israel. So that's one trend that is very clear. And we see also that there are multiple instances, documented ones on video, showing Israeli police carrying out basically collective punishment against areas that witness protests or riots. So Jaffa, so East Jerusalem, where you see completely empty streets and you see stun grenades and smoke grenades being fired. Again, this is something that is just straight up taken from the West Bank, a practice known as displaying presence, Hafganat Nochichut, or white nights, you know, basically preventing Palestinians from sleeping. So we're seeing basically, you know, and this is very natural. This is something that was predicted when the occupation first started of the West Bank that and Gaza, that it will bleed into Israel proper. And this is what we're seeing. Another trend is very clear. It has to do with Netanyahu and basically his the efforts that he made politically to empower the Kahanis, not because he likes them so much, but because he needs them to be able to form a government. This is why he convinced Smotrich to form, a joint umbrella party and run with them for the Knesset to ensure basically that Itamar Ben-Gvir becomes a member of Knesset. So basically we have for the first time since 1988 representation of the Kahanist movement, as you stated, inside the Knesset. Ben-Gvir has been convicted on, I think, 8 different charges, including inciting for terrorism and violence and support for a terrorist group. This is the group is Kach. It's a group that has been is outlawed not just in the U.S. It's not just designated as a terror group in the U.S., but also in Israel proper. The Netanyahu has done a lot to ensure basically that this party that was always so marginal and small that it failed to cross the electoral threshold, he basically allowed them to enter the parliament and gain this powerful voice and powerful platform. And therefore they played, we know, a major role in stoking up tensions in cities throughout the period of violence that we saw, the clashes between Jews and Palestinians, citizens of Israel. They participated both as Lehava, which is one group connected to the Kahanists, as well as La Familia, which is the ultras of Beitar Yerushalayim, a group that has been infiltrated deeply and now essentially controlled by Kahanists. So that's
just
another
to clarify, the ultras is linked to an Israeli soccer team.
Right. Beitar Yerushalayim, Beitar Jerusalem, which, Beitar is a revisionist Jewish movement started by Jabotinsky, but that fan club is basically controlled by racist, extremely racist elements. They protested against their own team when it when basically they hired two Chechen Muslim players. They take pride in being, you know, the most racist country, the most racist team in the country. So that group has been involved in violence against both leftist Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel before. And they played a prominent role in the rioting that we saw, the attacks on Palestinian citizens of Israel. And then another trend that we're seeing in Israel that very much helps explain both the death threats that we're seeing and also the environment in which much of the violence was organized is kind of the rise of right-wing media, very much owing to Netanyahu's efforts to threaten and Israeli media independence, to insert right-wing channels into the mainstream, to insert right-wing journalists into the mainstream. Those individuals, as well as his own son and Netanyahu himself, are using social media in particular, in addition to those right-wing journalists, I mean, journalist is not even a right term, more like propagandists, to basically incite against anyone who stands in Netanyahu's way to maintaining power, whether they're right wing or left wing. And Netanyahu personally previously kind of shied away from being explicit in his calls for violence and his incitement against anyone who is standing in his way. But he has become much more explicit. He's refusing to apologize. He's refusing to condemn really quite extreme language that is being used by his supporters, by his own son, to target both the left and the right who are uniting to unseat Netanyahu. So those are kind of the three major trends that I think, you know, are the reason we witnessed this unprecedented level of violence and incitement to the point that the Shin Bet has come out, the head of the Shin Bet has come out and said, you know, politicians need to cool down with this incitement because this can lead to, you know, another political murder.
Yeah, I mean, and this is another direction we could go, but I want to move on. But I will say that if we have time, maybe at the end, there's a lot of people in the United States watching this thinking this feels a lot like the end of the Trump era, with the, you know, which led to January 6th and all of that. I would say that it, you know, given the sort of overhanging memory of the Rabin assassination, it has particular, there's reason to be particularly concerned. It's striking seeing images of someone like Naftali Bennett, you know, in the keffiyeh, the way that they did Rabin. It's you know, politically, it's absurd to say that he's a leftist. But I mean, that's the kind of imagery that was, you know, the glide path to his assassination, which is something I think, you know, a lot of Israelis have either, it hasn't been sort of dealt with politically. So go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. And I much of the incitement by Netanyahu is also targeting the media, similarly to what Trump did. But in the U.S., because the media is quite strong and because the population, you know, can stay evenly split relatively between, you know, Republicans and Democrats, the media kind of held its ground. And actually, throughout the Trump presidency, was more explicit in calling out his racism and et cetera. In Israel, no, it's the other way around. This actual incitement against the media, which is related to Netanyahu's corruption trial much more than anything else, you know, he wants to undermine the faith that Israelis have in media reporting, which, you know, exposed much of this corruption that is now being on trial for. And Israel is actually working in silencing journalists who are afraid to be explicit, who are afraid to speak kind of openly about Netanyahu, about his role in the incitement. So it's actually been quite effective in getting them to self-censor because they fear losing their audience, which in Israel is, you know, most Israelis are center-right. And also, you know, likely a fear of just straight up being killed or assaulted. You know, a prominent Israeli presenter on television, Yonit Levy, was also pictured in a keffiyeh, similar to what was done to Rabin before his assassination.
Right, and we saw death threats this week against Tammy Zandberg. So it's right. a MK from from the left. So I want to move on to a related issue. Everything's related here, which is Jerusalem. And I want to talk about this specifically. We've had Palestinian voices talking about this. I want you to talk about this a little bit. So obviously, some Israeli officials and defenders of Israel, here in the U.S. as well, insist that what is going on in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan is nothing more than a real estate dispute, right? This is just real estate. This is business. And anyone who's trying to intervene clearly doesn't understand that. And we're here at this moment when, based on the attorney general in Israel yesterday declining to intervene on the Sheikh Jarrah case, which I guess maybe wasn't surprising, but is still really disappointing. We're on the verge of seeing a lot of Palestinians essentially ejected from their homes, having their land taken, and we're seeing two neighborhoods of East Jerusalem that are Palestinian neighborhoods for hundreds of years being turned into Jewish neighborhoods populated by the most right-wing ideological Israelis that exist. So, I want you to talk about this question of the real estate dispute. And you are someone who understands the settlement movement really well. You have personal experience with this. I mean, one thing that's striking to me every time someone says it's just a real estate dispute to defend why it's okay to do this, I think of all the settlers I know who would disagree, right? This is not a real estate dispute. This is what is it that is driving these groups to want to displace Palestinians from these areas? And how has that agenda, which was extremely marginal, right, in the 80s, it was a marginal agenda, but in 2021, it's now come into the mainstream to where we are today, where this is just happening and it's basically, get over it. It's a real estate dispute.
Right. So, I mean, obviously the claim that it's a real estate dispute is ridiculous. We could say that it's a real estate dispute if there was a situation of legal parity between Jews and Arabs or Jews and Palestinians, and both had laws that are, that give the same rights to both people. In that case, yes, we basically would have a dispute, but this is absolutely not the case. Palestinians who lost their property, during the Nakba cannot reclaim that property, while Jews who lost their property in 48, and purchased it before the establishment of the State of Israel, can now go back and sue. In addition to the fact that the Sheikh Jarrah case and many other cases of purchases of housing, of land, etc., entails just deceptive practices that are being used by organizations of the settler movement. The process of the settlement of Jerusalem, I think, is part of an overall project of the settler movement to settle in places, and I think you, Lara, know more about this than I do, of settling in places that would make a two-state solution impossible. To basically, they want this kind of interaction and intermixing to basically prevent kind of the possibility of the emergence of a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. If there are so many Jews in areas that are supposed to go to the Palestinians, it will be harder to execute. And we see this pattern also in, for example, the construction of Ariel, the establishment of outposts throughout the West Bank. And I think that project has largely been successful, right? So I think, on your podcast, the conversations that you've been having, it's very clear that the narrative that the discourse is shifting. There is a recognition that the two-state solution is increasingly unrealistic. Now, the solution that is advocated, therefore, by settlers is either maintaining of the status quo or a full-on apartheid reality with annexation of the West Bank without granting any rights to the Palestinians, or a solution that is even more extreme, one advocated by Kahanists and people slightly more moderate even than Kahanists, is the idea of transfers, the idea of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians forcibly or sometimes through economic inducement to Jordan, to other areas. And the practices of the State of Israel in Jerusalem are kind of very much in line with this quite extreme transferist ideology. Because of the loss of residency that Palestinians from East Jerusalem, if they move to the West Bank or if they go to study abroad, after a few years, they lose their residency in East Jerusalem. So there is clearly a project in place of displacement. And this, and you know, changing the demographic character of Jerusalem. So to say that this is a real estate dispute is utterly ridiculous. All of this is happening as part of a larger political project of the state of Israel, working hand in hand with private NGOs sometimes that are supported by the state to displace Palestinians from their homes.
I think it's interesting what you said when you started out, the question of legal parity. And, you know, one thing I struggle to get people to understand sometimes, you know, they say, well, Israel's democracy, there's laws. And I've really tried to focus people on the distinction between rule of law and rule by law. And rule by law is relevant to this conversation because extremism, illiberalism, authoritarianism, rule by law, which is where laws are made to serve the goals of the people in charge at the expense of people who are disfavored, that is how more authoritarian governments work everywhere. Someone was talking about, well, this is the law. And I'm like, well, you know, in the West Bank, it's the law that settlers can't go in and take Palestinian private land and build houses on it. But when they do, Israel changes the law to let them keep it, right? Mm-hmm. Again, rule by law. So speaking of authoritarianism, let's zoom out a little bit. Obviously, you've done a great deal of research, more than really anyone I know, on Syria, on the ground in Syria, and on movements for democratic change in the Middle East and North Africa. You've traveled and worked in Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Turkey for research, and you maintain a network of contacts in all these places, including among activists, leaders, and in Syria, people who are actually engaged in what is going on the ground for years now, which started as a civil war and has turned into something much worse. So based on all that, so does violence, repression, authoritarianism inside these countries that surround Israel, how does it relate? Does it relate to what's happening in Israel-Palestine? And if the answer is yes, somehow it relates, can you explain how? You know, how do the dynamics in the broader Middle East, like the civil war in Syria, the fight over authority and government, efforts to suppress democracy and demands for minority rights and human rights and civil rights and all that in Arab countries, the Kurdish struggle, and the rise in refugees, how does that affect what happens in Israel-Palestine? Or does it?
No, I mean, for sure it is connected, and connected in multiple ways. I think first, a trend that we're seeing throughout the Middle East is the fear that many minorities have of democratic rule, which they perceive will empower forces that will oppress them. We're seeing this very clearly in Syria, where the Alawis are a tiny minority who are in charge and fear very much the emergence of any kind of democratic change in the country, where they fear that they will be the ones paying the price. We see it in Iraq, for example, where I've interviewed members of many minorities, where they genuinely fear the emergence of kind of a strong democracy, that, and they see the fall of Saddam as kind of a catastrophe, because there was a strong authoritarian leader representing a minority sect that protected them, who protected them against, you know, the hordes. And I think that, I mean, we see this mentality also in upper class elites that are, you know, not driven by ethnic fear or sectarian fears, but by class fears of the unwashed masses, etc. We see it among Copts in Egypt, who are strong backers of Sisi. And I think we see it in Israel. Israel is basically a country of a minority, a Jewish minority in the middle of the Middle East, which is, you know, mostly Muslim. And there is a strong fear of democracy in this region. So very early, when the Arab Spring just started, before, you know, it turned into a horror show, there were immediately fears in Israel, which I think in hindsight, we can understand that some of them were quite justified. But there was this immediate paranoia about, oh, this is going to transcend from kind of an Arab Spring into an Islamist winter. There's always this fear of democracy in the Middle East. And this is why I think we see this kind of a very robust connection between Israel and authoritarian regimes, particularly in the Gulf, that are also very fearful of democracy, whether it comes in the form of Islamism or liberalism. Both camps are punished, both camps are persecuted, dissidents from both camps end up in prisons, and they end up in prison oftentimes owing to software sold by Israeli companies to these authoritarian regimes with the approval of the Israeli Ministry of Defense. This is a very important point. It's true that the ones selling are private companies, but because these are highly sophisticated and powerful tools, they are subject to approval, basically export controls by the Israeli MOD. So any such software that ended anywhere to spy on Jamal Khashoggi before his brutal murder, spy on other dissidents in Bahrain, in the UAE, in Saudi Arabia, all of this was done with the approval of the Israeli MOD. So we're seeing basically kind of the Middle East being divided between kind of two major authoritarian axes. One that includes Israel, the Emirates, Egypt, the monarchies of the region in general. And the other one is kind of the so-called axis of resistance, which is just as oppressive and aggressive, in some ways even more, includes the Assad regime, which has slaughtered hundreds of thousands of civilians, Hezbollah, which intervened in the war in Syria, helped kill and besiege Syrians, Iran, obviously interfering in supporting Bashar in Syria, supporting militias that are hunting down activists in Iraq, and suppressing protests in Lebanon. And basically, the people who are left to pay the price of all of this are the populations, which are suffering really under the yoke of two kind of oppressive axes. And there really isn't kind of a real power in the region that is supportive of democratization. And in that kind of context, there's no surprise that the activists of the region, people who are yearning for something different, for some political change, are really struggling to make any advances, when really the everything is stacked up against them. They essentially have no allies except each other, trying to share knowledge, trying to help one another. But this is hardly enough when facing such repressive regimes that enjoy international backing as well.
Listening to you, I mean, it's very striking to me, the idea that there's almost the opposite of a virtuous cycle here, where illiberalism in the region is in many ways, it is, I don't want to say it's fueling, but it's certainly consistent with growing illiberalism in Israel. And growing illiberalism in Israel is literally supporting the greater illiberalism in the region. And I mean, just to observations. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Israeli politicians as recently as not long ago demanding that Palestinians be, you know, perfect European Democrats, small d, before they are, you know, before they deserve and have earned a state of their own. And you know, still to this day, you can find a press release, no doubt today, from some, you know, organization in the U.S. proclaiming Israel as the region's only democracy, which has a certain ironic flavor to it when you have now Israel, through normalization deals and other things, actively playing a role in preventing democracy or undermining the forces that are fighting for it other places. It's really quite depressing. I'm curious if you have any observations about the normalization trends, because obviously that was the Trump administration says, you know, that was their biggest accomplishment in the Middle East. They brought peace to all these countries that weren't actually at war. But you know, exactly. It is an accomplishment, right? That exists. There are now these normalization agreements. And it seems by all sort of indications that that's going to continue to be a priority for the Biden administration. It's politically, you know, easy, cost-free, gets you lots of benefits, and certainly in Congress, and it's obviously supported by Israel. Do you want to offer some observations about how those normalization trends either feed into this this sort of illiberal love fest, or maybe if there's some other direction you see it going?
So, of course, this normalization is largely the result of this alignment between Israel and authoritarian regimes in the region, particularly monarchies, that are deeply fearful of their population, deeply fearful of Iran, deeply fearful of political Islam, and all kind of uniting in one front together to combat these threats. And the initial warming of relations and cooperation between Israel and those countries really focused on security and intelligence sharing and surveillance and hacking phones of activists, etc. And from there, they're now trying to build other things on top of it, such as, you know, civilian trade, tourism, etc. So I think that that's obviously the people who are paying the price for this normalization obviously are Palestinians, who lost a major playing card, one of the few that they had in their hands, and also the citizens of these regimes that are normalizing, which, first of all, there's now an additional issue that they cannot speak up against. Previously, they were free to express their views with regards to Israel if they were, largely negative towards Israel and supportive of Palestinian rights. Now they have to keep silent about that. But also, the transfer of technology will just be made easier to those regimes to hunt down critics. Now, with regards to the normalization itself, how it is playing out on the ground, I think that the recent recent fighting between Israel and the factions in Gaza, and also the ongoing repression and plans to evict families from Sheikh Jarrah, we see a great deal of solidarity from citizens of countries that normalize relations. So I always keep an eye on trending topics in the UAE, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, in Egypt. And public sentiment is, at least, as represented by these trending topics, but also polls that have been done throughout recent years, show that there's actually quite limited support for normalization. The voices that support normalizations are the ones getting airtime on Israeli media, which loves these people, no matter how, completely marginal they are in their own societies. And obviously, the media outlets of these regimes who are trying to push and legitimize normalization. But we see that there's a great deal of solidarity and sense of affinity with the Palestinians, with Gazans. And I don't think that that's about to change. At the same time, it is true that the Arab uprisings have focused people across the region on the oppression and corruption of their own regimes, which at times use the issue of Palestine to justify all sorts of oppressive measures against their own population, such as emergency laws, etc. So there has been some change when it comes to Israel. There is a sense that you see it particularly, for example, among Syrians. Even I heard this from Iraqis, that, we wish we were living under Israeli occupation, things like that, because our own regimes are so much worse. But, of course, there are worse things in the world than Israeli occupation. A regime like Bashar's that uses chemical weapons against its own people, obviously that's worse. But overall, I would say that the general kind of public sentiment is very much in support of the Palestinians and their rights, despite the efforts of Gulf regimes to alter public discourse and the perceptions of their subjects.
That's actually a great segue to my last question. And I will add as an observation, I mean, years of normalization, which were actually peace treaties with Jordan and Egypt, have done little to change public sentiment as well. I mean, the cold peace that Israelis, have always complained about. And there's lots of reasons for that. But if that's an example, and those were, peace treaties that dealt real benefits to both Jordan right. and Egypt, but for the people that the grassroots sentiment didn't change. I want to, as a last question, I want you to take out your crystal ball. I hate it when people ask me these questions, but I'm going to do it to you. And I want to ask you what you see the future of these, what I see as extremist trends in Israel, where they go. We now have an incredibly fragile coalition taking power, in theory. And that coalition includes some extreme elements. It is going to be in power with in a Knesset that has the most extreme elements of any Knesset since the 80s, to the backdrop of a nation where Jewish Israelis seem largely untroubled by things like, oh, I don't know, since the violence in the mixed cities during the Gaza war, that almost everyone who's being arrested are Palestinian citizens of Israel, despite the fact that there was enormous amounts of violence by Jewish citizens. So where do you see those trends inside Israel going? And here's where I ask you for maybe offering some note of hope. Do you see any sort of off-ramp from the current trajectory in Israel that seems to be leading since really the early 90s towards ever greater illiberalism and extremism?
So I think, I mean, it's incredibly difficult to predict what will happen. I think there is there are genuine concerns now about the possibility of another political murder or attempted murder, which I think can change the dynamics quite a bit. You know, after Rabin was assassinated, there was some reckoning among the Israeli right. There was a sense that these people went too far, and there were discussions inside the community. So that, for example, could really shift kind of the dynamics that we're seeing on the ground now. Overall, I would say I would agree with you. The trends are incredibly troubling. There is acceptance of incitement against just anyone who stands in Netanyahu's way. Really, the Likud party, which used to be a deeply ideological movement, you know, we can disagree with the ideology, but it had some principles that it was maybe an odd combination of liberal principles and nationalism, but there was an ideology there, you know, articulated by people like Jabotinsky, like Shamir, like Eldad, that now has really been transformed into kind of a personality cult of Netanyahu. And he is just losing it, you know, because he is, you know, it's not just his political future is on the line. It's also his ability to shape Israel's law and order, institutions, judiciary, police, which will affect his, you know, possibility of ending up in prison for the corruption charges that he's facing. So we're in a very, very dangerous moment right now. And therefore, it's a bit difficult to predict what will happen. I think there are some notes of there are reasons to be optimistic. First of all, you know, even though the next coalition will not do anything to, you know, end the occupation, I think merely not having Netanyahu around as this dominant figure who is, you know, actively inciting against different groups whenever it suits them, and this mob, this mass of people who just follow what he says, I think that this is incredibly important. To not have a prime minister constantly inciting against the police, against the courts, against you know, Arabs who support terrorism, when he tries to delegitimize taking part in a government with the Arab members of Knesset, as he's doing now. So I think that's something that is positive. I think for all citizens of Israel, Jews and Palestinians. Now, another note of optimism is the fact that the next government will likely include a Palestinian or Arab-Israeli party, Ra'am. Definitely, you know, not my cup of tea, an Islamist party, deeply homophobic. But I think that it may change dynamics in Israel when you have prime minister and parties, like the members of this coalition, including people like Benny Gantz, like Naftali Bennett, like Yair Lapid, who previously, you know, made political capital off of inciting against Arabs as well, or showing, you know, how strong they are against Arabs, against Palestinians, now having to justify sitting in a government with that party. And because Netanyahu took that first step, I think that this can have a very positive dynamic to relations between Israelis and Palestinians inside Jewish Israelis and Palestinians.
Can I ask you a bonus question?
Sure.
I am struck by the fact that you had someone like Ayman Odeh, who speaks like a member of Peace Now, right? This is a guy who speaks the language of coexistence. And I mean, if you were trying to invent the absolute most reasonable, articulate partner amongst the Palestinian citizens of Israel, it would be Ayman Odeh. And yet, you know, Israeli parties could not manage to make themselves go into coalition with him, but they're okay going into coalition with a misogynist, Islamist, homophobic party. I mean, explain that to me.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that Ram is a good fit for the Islamist party, is a good fit for the current coalition and one that Netanyahu would form, in the sense that he is kind of whatever coalition is formed in Israel, it will likely now be this so-called change coalition, or if a coalition had been formed by Netanyahu, it would have been dominated by forces of the right. So actually having an Islamist party in that kind of coalition is a good fit. But also, you know, Ram essentially, and I'm not judging, and clearly they had electoral success that indicates that some people in the Palestinian public in Israel are interested in that kind of politics. They basically decided to behave as a sector. Basically, we just want our share. We just want our problems inside Israel addressed. Whereas the joint list is much more of a political project. It has political demands that do not pertain merely to quality of life of Palestinians in Israel, but also issues pertaining to ending the occupation, certain policies, I'm sure, with regards to Gaza, etc. And this is something that the dominant Israeli parties, whether on the center, soft center left like Yair Lapid, or the right, are completely unwilling to countenance. So therefore, I think it actually makes sense to have such a party that is very much focused on getting budgets, on getting certain power inside the government to allocate funds and projects, etc., and set certain priorities, as opposed to a party that has kind of an ideological program that they want to enact.
I don't remember if it was you or someone else on Twitter who observed that in some ways, if you want to understand how they're behaving, you should look at Shas. They're like
right.
Behaving the way Shas behaves, but from the Palestinian sector, which is just fascinating. I'm not sure anyone would have predicted that 20 years ago, that this would be the way that a Palestinian party finally enters into the mainstream of Israeli politics.
I think that we're really seeing kind of very there are significant developments within the Palestinian community in Israel of increasing economic integration and increasing desire to really participate in politics. And at the same time, we're also seeing, you know, a great deal of frustration and anger and growing criminality due to neglect, due to lack of economic development of Palestinian citizens in Israel. That we saw much of it, you know, manifest in the rioting that took place and the attacks that took place against, you know, Jewish businesses and homes in several cities throughout the country.
Which brings us back in our arc. I know an arc is not a circle. It brings us back full circle to the issue of illiberalism and extremism. And really, I mean, I think the next conversation I want to have with you will look, I want to dig in with you onto that question of sort of how does that growing integration, if it's in a race with the growing extremism in Israeli society, where does that end? Because these are two trends that actually contradict each other. But let's save that for our next conversation. Elizabeth, this was terrific. Thank you so much for joining me today. And thanks for sharing your insights with the foundation and with our listeners. There is so much more to dig into and unpack. And I guarantee we will be asking you to come back.
You have been listening to a discussion between Laura Friedman and Elizabeth Jachar, examining the role of extremism and violence in Israel's domestic and regional policies. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive, to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. إلى